right, we're back.
We're back.
It's been a really long time.
Yeah.
I think we should try and record more than like 3 episodes a year.
Yeah, I think we record it and then a year goes by and then we record it again. So it's probably a year breaks between the seasons, but...
Oh, it's because we're busy, right? I mean, yeah. It's
a good thing.
The podcast was born during COVID when we weren't busy, and now we actually have a company.
Travel company with people who can travel.
Yeah, a travel company with people who can travel, right. And I guess on top of that, I've also been traveling and doing something slightly different.
Yeah.
Related to Trunks and Tracks, but also not directly related to Trunks and Tracks.
Yeah, just kind of a new branch of Trunks and Tracks.
Yeah, a new branch. That's a good way of describing it. Yeah, so I've been down in Antarctica for the last 2 sort of summer seasons now. Yeah, it's pretty, still pretty interesting and like amazing to say that, that I've spent the two seasons down there now. And yeah, I got back in January from the last stint. So I think that's what we're going to start talking about in the first few episodes of the season, just because it's very different. But also similar in that it's very much a wildlife-based experience.
Yeah, cold safari.
Cold safari.
Cold snowy safari.
Cold snowy ice safari. And then maybe after a few episodes of that, we might finish the season with a couple of Africa episodes as well, because we also explored Tanzania a little bit last year.
Yeah, and had some great sightings.
Definitely had some very cool sightings. But I think just for Antarctica, we're going to talk a little bit about what the experience is like when you travel down there.
I mean, I think similar to safari, going on your first safari, Antarctica is very unfamiliar to people. You know, maybe a few people know someone that's been or have heard of someone who knows someone who's been. But, you know, I think a lot of people do think of it kind of as like the last frontier. Is that, would you say that's right?
Yeah, yeah.
Very much like a kind of last unexplored area or... semi-explored area, which I think we'll touch on a little bit today, but...
Definitely. And then we'll talk a little bit about, so, I mean, what it's like on the ship, what the experience is when you leave the ship down there and go on actual excursions. Some cool sightings that I've had will punctuate the next few episodes, definitely, because everybody wants to know about the cool stuff that you see.
Penguinos.
Penguins, whales, seals, And then... I have to talk about South Georgia, because South Georgia is very much a part of Antarctica. And
to me, it's all in the same bucket. But is South Georgia not considered Antarctica?
No, it's not. It's a sub-Antarctic island, but it's definitely, you know, in terms of the ecosystem and what you see down there, I would group it under Antarctica as well, south of the Antarctic convergence or the polar front. And then definitely also a little bit about the history, because, you know, it would be kind of strange to talk about the coldest, driest, windiest, least inhabitable place on the planet without talking about some of its early explorers. And you said the final frontier now, and certainly it was for a very long time the last unexplored place on the planet.
Also driest, we're gonna have to circle back on that, because covered in ice, I don't really think of it as dry, but now that I think of it, probably doesn't rain.
Exactly. I mean, climate change is certainly changing some things about it, and that is something that we'll probably talk a little bit about during this season as well. But you can listen from the comfort of your couch or car or wherever you might be listening to it. And while I was on these extremely modern, well, some of them were extremely modern, some of them were
a little bit older,
but I was on these relatively very modern vessels, so for me it was exploring in a very comfortable way and only really retracing the footsteps of some of these early explorers. But I think let's get on into it, right?
Yeah, I mean, how far back are we going, like when?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the way that I want to do this, and I hope that this translates well to the medium of podcast, is that I want to talk about it chronologically, or as chronologically as I can, and then also geographically, so going further south in latitude as the various explorers who went down there also went further and further south. And if we talk really early, we need to talk about Antarctica as a concept more than anything else. It was an idea that both Greek and then Roman philosophers.
Like the world being flat.
Yeah, exactly.
Type vibe.
Exactly. Well, you know, there was land in the north that people knew about, right? The Romans and the Greeks knew about it. But they theorized that because there's so much land in the north of the planet, there must be land to the south as well. So this idea...
So they reached the Arctic.
Well, I don't think... not necessarily the Arctic. I just mean like Europe and, you know, Africa, places that were known about,
yeah,
that were in the north, in the northern hemisphere, that there would also be land to the south. And that's called Terra Australis, or the southern land. And this land supposedly had to balance out the land in the north.
So that's that they theorized that Antarctica existed.
They theorized it existed, exactly. And based upon this theory, many of the explorers went down there looking for it.
Yeah.
But now, so the Romans and the Greeks, they would be kind of, you know, people that had written history, and we know about this through written history, but there's also indigenous peoples and cultures in various parts of the planet, but especially in South America and in the Pacific, where oral tradition and oral history has kind of told us that they believed that there was an Antarctic continent as well.
Mm.
And the Yamanas and the Ono, there's a few different like native people in South America, very few of which are still remaining, but the Yamanas are one of them, people who inhabited the Tierra del Fuego area.
That's a national park.
Well, it's a national park, but it's also an archipelago. So that's basically a group of islands.
Right.
That's south. The most southern part of South America is Tierra del Fuego.
Yeah.
The land of fire, because the first Europeans who wrote about that area in the dark, while sailing along the coast in the darkness, saw these fires, which like punctuated the landscape there.
The fires were from...
belonging to the Yamanas people, oh, okay. Yeah. And...
I did not know that's why it was named that.
Yeah, through oral tradition, we know that the Yamanas had a knowledge of Antarctica, or had a knowledge that Antarctica existed or exists. Along with that, the Polynesians and Maori specifically, who also have an oral history rather than written, tell of Hui Te Rangiora, who 1,300 years ago, so in the 7th century, is believed to have made it into Antarctic waters. And now you're talking about people that essentially sailed...
like a sailboat.
Not
a
just...
a little sailboat.
Yeah, not just sailboats, but like kind of
canoes.
Like dhows or canoes.
Yeah.
Like tiny, tiny boats. He's believed to have sighted the continent, but it's not written about, but it is worth mentioning. And I think on that note, we also need to talk about like the Polynesians' ability to navigate the seas, using just knowledge of stars, celestial bodies. Like I can barely get to the shops here around the corner without using Google Maps.
I mean, you can, but...
No, right. No, but I mean, like these guys navigated we know that they were able to navigate a distance of 2,300 miles from Hawaii.
Crazy,
to a different part of Polynesia, using kind of weather patterns, warm and cold winds and currents, and just having a general understanding of, you know, what regional weather was doing. And to me, it's just remarkable, and it's just not really talked about that much in the exploration of Antarctica, but very relevant, because the likelihood is maybe they did make it down there. So
right.
we should mention that.
Yeah.
Now we
but
need...
definitely when it comes to Antarctica exploration, I feel like there's a few names that stand out that first come to mind, I would say.
100%. There's a few names that first come to mind. One of the first ones that I think of is Sir Francis Drake. I would say, I don't know why he's named Sir. he was around in the 16th century. He was what's called a privateer. Privateer is essentially a pirate.
Oh.
So it just means that you were a pirate. You were pirating on
for hire?
Pirating on behalf of the country that you worked
for.
Yeah,
so a pirate for
a
hire.
Pirate for hire.
National pirate for hire.
He was heavily involved in the slave trade.
Oh,
right. Where do you think he was from?
Spain?
No. Britain.
Britain.
Yeah. he's well known for being the first person or part of the first kind of expedition to circumnavigate the world in one go. And he made it around the southern tip of South America. Okay. And that's why that body of water, so...
I feel like most people have heard of the Drake Shake, but probably don't know that this is where the name comes from.
The Drake Passage, yeah.
Well, and the Drake Shake, I feel like, is what people... A lot of people who know something about Antarctica have heard about the Drake Shake.
Absolutely.
And this is
so
where the name comes from.
How the trips start when you actually head down to Antarctica is... You generally will start in the port city of Ushuaia, which is in the Beagle Channel, which is the channel or the body of water that separates Argentina and then Tierra del Fuego, which belongs to Chile, right at the southern tip of South America. And most ships that go on these trips down to Antarctica will start in Ushuaia, and they then need to cross what's called the Drake Passage in order to get down to Antarctica. Now, the Drake Passage is named after Sir Francis Drake. He's probably not the first person to have actually sailed into it.
I mean, naturally.
Naturally. That title actually belongs to a person called William Schouten, who worked on behalf of the Dutch East India Company. But anyway, that doesn't matter that much. The Drake Passage is this notorious body of water. It's probably what's arguably the most turbulent body of water on the planet, and that's simply because it is... water can move unobstructed all around the Antarctic continent in this kind of clockwise motion, and it can just pick up speed.
With no land.
There's no obstruction.
There's no obstruction, right?
So you have to imagine that these seafarers who were coming down into these areas first, we're talking now Europeans 500 years ago or so, on these small ships of often like between, call it 60 and 120 feet in length, think about how they would have been shaken up in those bodies of water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you get shook up in them now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. It's
on a ship that has
on these
balancer to prevent you feeling, you know,
yeah,
they've got stabilizers
on them. Exactly. And it's still, you know, I'm lucky in that I don't get seasick at all, but believe me, a lot of people do.
Well, so to bring that full circle, the Drake Shake, there's kind of this like joke or saying that when you're crossing the Drake Passage, it's either the Drake Shake or the Drake Lake. And it can be flat like a lake and super smooth sailing, or it can be super rough. And then you've got the Drake Shake and you're kind of getting tossed around as you transit across.
Yeah. And it's more often than not the Drake Shake. It's more often than not, I would say the average kind of height of the waves in the Drake is about 4 to 5 meters. So that's like 12 to 15 feet, sometimes up to 20 feet. And then above 20 feet, generally the ships try not to cross or get stuck in there because... it's then not necessarily dangerous for the ships, but certainly dangerous for the passengers on the ships, because if you're walking around in 20-foot seas, you know, you're not walking. You can't really walk. So it's no longer a pleasant experience for the passengers to go down there. But the reason that I'm mentioning all of this is that the Drake Passage, for people even going down there now, is sort of a rite of passage to get to the Antarctic continent, because so many explorers... lost their lives doing it on the way down there while exploring the continent or trying to find the continent. And
yeah, I think there's an element of kind of you have to go through it, like to get to this incredible, pristine, raw, rough wilderness area. You kind of have to do the work.
Yeah, you gotta...
The work is making it across the Drake. Maybe with a little bit of seasickness.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the most fun day and a half of your life, but it's like, you get the badge, you did it, you made it, and now you get to, you know, explore this incredible ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about 500 nautical miles or so between the southern tip of Tierra del Fuego and Cape Horn and the South Shetland Islands, which is the Drake Passage. And that takes about 2 days to cross in a ship nowadays.
I know, we're getting distracted. So back in the olden days, those guys crossing... Well, I guess who was crossing? Who was trying to make it there?
So I guess the first thing is, because it's 500 nautical miles, sailors way back when and prior to the mid-18th century used something called an astrolabe. And they had various different devices that they could use to determine latitude. And they had a fairly good idea of what latitude they were at. But until the advent of the sextant and the chronometer, they didn't. Yeah, I'll explain what these are.
Okay.
they didn't really know exactly where they were. So
fun.
Anything that I mentioned, like Francis Drake, for example, he didn't know exactly where he was most of the time.
Pretty bold.
It's pretty insane to think that he made it around the world in kind of one expedition without knowing truly where he was in terms of longitude.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, there was another guy called Anthony de la Roche who actually made it down to South Georgia, which is south of the Antarctic Convergence. But
what is the South Africa? What South Africa?
Yeah.
What is the Antarctic Convergence?
Yeah, the Antarctic Convergence, or it's now called the Polar Front, it's basically a line that is an ecological boundary where the cold Antarctic waters meet the warmer waters for the north.
That's the cold water area.
Yeah, exactly. And anything south of the Antarctic Convergence or Polar Front, ecologically speaking, you would deem to be Antarctica because you get very similar species there.
And very specific species, I would assume.
Yeah.
Like that aren't really many other
Definitely.
Species.
Yeah, exactly. There's some endemic species.
Right.
Yeah. That being said, that line moves depending on the time of year.
Well, that's interesting.
Because...
Yeah, I mean, seasons exist,
On the season. You would find also that once you hit that Antarctic Convergence, it's about halfway between the kind of southern tip of South America and the South Shetlands. You hit very often when you're sailing down there these fog banks. So it becomes, the visibility becomes very difficult.
Oh, that's so, like going to Swakopmund.
To Swakopmund.
Like driving, I'm just thinking.
Right, well,
in
it
Namibia.
Gets colder because you have that cold current that comes up
from
along.
Antarctica. You have like hot desert air that meets this cold Antarctic weather and you get these massive fog banks.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it Antarctic weather
off
the coast of Namibia, but I would certainly call it a cold current.
Yes.
Yeah. So imagine you're one of these sailors who A, doesn't really know where they are, and B, now hits these big fog banks, and then C, on top of that, because the water gets a lot colder, it becomes more nutritious, there's a lot more phytoplankton, there's a lot more krill, and you start getting lots more big animals. So you get whales, you start seeing seals, you start seeing more penguins, even out in the open ocean, you start seeing penguins there. And then you also start seeing icebergs. So generally, we usually have an iceberg competition, which is where you have to kind of guess when you think you're going to see the first iceberg, what time and, you know, what day and stuff. And it's always always south of the convergence. But now imagine being the likes of Captain Cook, who's the next kind of important guy in our story. And
British.
Also British.
They love to explore.
They love to explore. Anyway, sorry. So in the mid-18th century, there's these two things that are invented. One is the sextant, which was independently invented by two different people at the same time, by a person called John Hadley.
Hi!
In England, and then Thomas Godfrey in America. And the sextant, I asked ChatGPT to explain to me how a sextant works as if explaining it to a 7-year-old, and it's still very complicated.
Skip it.
I'm not going to go into detail about this. It just basically measures the distance between the horizon and various celestial bodies. So it can be the sun, or it can be stars at night. And using charts of these celestial bodies, you determine your longitude. A chronometer is basically the word for a watch. So it's a watch that works properly by itself without needing any without needing to be set. So it works at sea regardless of like humidity and regardless of where you are in terms of the magnetic poles. These two things help people understand where they are in the ocean, and that helps Captain Cook, who's also definitely not the best big enabler of British colonialism,
big in the slave trade.
I think he had a part to play in the slave trade, but just a big enabler of British colonialism, especially in the Pacific. He was, however, a very gifted seafarer and a cartographer who mapped massive parts of the Pacific in the 1770s. Aboard the HMS Resolution, his ship, which is 110 feet, he gets to 71 degrees south, which is the first time any European or anybody in written history crosses the Antarctic Circle. So the Antarctic Circle being 66 degrees south.
Well done.
Yeah. Well done. Yeah, you know what? Well done. Bit of an asshole, but well done.
Give him a handshake and send him home.
Exactly. He also, on several different expeditions, managed to circumnavigate the continent. However, he didn't sight the continent. And you might think that's strange. How does he know he circumnavigated the continent? Well, we know because we know where he was. He knows where he was. And he came remarkably close to the shoreline, but he probably had to turn back because of things like icebergs, fog, conditions. Visibility down there is often very, very poor. And I mean like only several hundred meters. So he could have been really, really close to the continent
itself.
Yeah,
I can imagine his ship would not have ice breaking capabilities. So definitely, that's a limiting factor.
Definitely. We do know that he was trying to sight the continent, though. He wrote about that. Sea ice is another one. So the continent at most times of year, most parts of the continent are surrounded by sea ice. And the seafarers knew what sea ice was.
Sea ice is frozen ocean.
Frozen ocean, because the air
for
temperature...
potentially miles.
Yeah, absolutely, for miles. Now, that sea ice can be fast in the form of fast ice, which means that it's attached to the coast or to the, the continent, or it can be in the form of drift ice or pack ice, which means that it's just big pieces or chunks of ice that are floating around that are moving with the currents themselves.
So many questions, but
okay.
I'm going to save them for later episodes because
okay.
I feel like we have more exploration to cover.
There's more...
But we'll delve deep into the ice and the icebergs and what uses them and
sure.
why and all that.
Sure. Now, 71 degrees south is really far south already. The northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula is about 60 degrees south. So Cook made it 71 down to 71, but he didn't see the continent. I'll also mention that for his sins, he eventually died while he was trying to kidnap the chief of a Hawaiian island.
Oh, God. Really not great.
Yeah.
All right, so who's next?
Okay, so now we get to the first sighting of the continent.
Wow, that's so karma. Ooh.
Yeah. We get to the first sighting of the continent, and it's by a man called Bellingshausen, who was Russian.
Okay. Mixing it up.
On behalf of the Russian Empire and Alexander I, he goes down with the intent of seeing the continent. And he actually stops in England and he picks up some of Cook's charts. So what I find interesting is at this time, you know, 1819, Europe is a hostile political climate. There are, you know, nations are at war. You've got big colonial powers sort of going up against each other. It's kind of nice to think that somebody like an explorer went to get the help of another explorer, get the charts of another explorer. And that there was sort of that was able to happen, and that he then managed to sight the continent first, which he did. So he sighted land south of the circle on the 27th of January in 1820, in a place called Queen Maud Land, which is East Antarctica. So it's east of the Antarctic Peninsula, if that makes sense. So that Antarctic Peninsula, for anybody,
Wait, it was the peninsula or it's an island?
No, it's the mainland, the continent. Yeah, it's east of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Got it.
Yeah.
I'm confused.
Yeah. So the peninsula is that kind of...
Oh, the jut.
Needle-like headland or that big peninsula that kind of looks almost like it resembles a mirror of South America.
Right.
The southern tip of South America.
It's the little, like, it's the big offshoot.
Yeah, it's the area that we visit.
Right.
When we go on these trips most regularly. I mean, we go to other places as well, but that's the area in Antarctica that we visit.
So that's the peninsula.
Yeah.
And the continent is the continent. It is part of the continent, but when you're referring to the continent, you mean like south of the peninsula, everything but the peninsula.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
So he sighted, the Russian explorer sighted the continent of Antarctica, not the part that's the peninsula.
Yeah, exactly. Then, just 3 days later, you have a guy called Ed Bransfield who sights the peninsula. So he sights the Trinity Peninsula, which is part of the Antarctic Peninsula. And in his honor, the Bransfield Strait was named, which is that body of water that separates the South Shetland Islands and the Antarctic Peninsula.
I mean, surely all these places are named after people.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. Then you have an American, the first American down there, called Nathaniel Palmer, nice American name, who on the 20th of November 1820, so about 10, 11 months after these other guys, while he's looking for seal breeding grounds, because he was a sealer, a lot of these guys who were down in this area first were hunting seals for their blubber, for their fat, and also for their fur. He also sees
the peninsula,
and he there's a whole area down there called the Palmer Archipelago.
Classic.
He was on a sloop called the Hero.
Sloop?
Sloop is like a small sailboat, which was like, I'm trying to remember, it was like 45 feet long or so, so he would have crossed the Drake in that.
Yeah.
Also just crazy, yeah. Now, sighting land down there and actually landing on land, they're two very, very different things.
Question also, does landing on ice attached to land count? Like if you land on sea ice.
No.
You have to land on, you have to be on land.
Yeah, it needs to be firm land of some description, yeah. So, but sighting land and actually landing on it are two very different things. And when you go down there, you know, I've mentioned, I used the word inhospitable. It's just, there's glaciers everywhere. These glaciers drop off into the ocean, straight down.
Yeah.
There's no way to land there. It would be exceptionally dangerous. So there's very few, that peninsula especially also is extremely mountainous, and those mountains are very, very steep. So it's not like there's flat beaches where you can land. That being said, in 1821, a guy called John Davis, who was also a sealer, also looking for sealing grounds, he claimed to have landed at a place called Hughes Bay on the peninsula, also while he was looking for seal breeding grounds. But that claim was never really proved substantiated by anyone. So,
a lot of guys trying.
Yeah, a lot of guys trying.
A lot
trying.
Of guys getting close.
Exactly. We now have a couple of other people who start not just looking for Antarctica, but they're starting to look for the South Pole. So there's a guy called James Weddell. He was
Weddell
also
sea.
He was also a sealer.
Oh God, guys!
In the early 1820s.
What about exploring just for the spirit of it?
Yeah. Well, I think that these guys used sealing as a means to do it, because these expeditions needed to be funded by something,
I'm sure,
right?
They're expensive.
So Weddell, while looking for better sealing grounds, went further south in what's now called the Weddell Sea, which is that body of water that's directly east of the peninsula.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he made it down to 74 degrees south while looking for these better sealing grounds. And he then theorized you could sail to the South Pole. So he didn't know that the South Pole was on land.
Buddy.
Nobody knew. I mean, nobody knew, right?
It's like, so obvious now.
Yeah, it's so obvious now, but nobody knew. You then have another gentleman called James Clark Ross. He explored what's now called the Ross Sea, and he discovered the Ross Ice Shelf, which is important because it's the way that most of the guys who later went on managed to get up onto the Antarctic Plateau.
Yeah.
The Ross Ice Shelf, or it also is known or was known as the Great Ice Shelf, that's this big ice shelf where a massive glacier essentially feeds this, it's like a wall of between 50 feet and 150 feet tall that is
ice,
and that is just in the sea. It's attached to the mainland.
Yeah.
And the ice goes, it's on the water, it's over the water and below the water. Yeah, exactly. But he then also decided it's too dangerous. I can't go further south. He was trying to determine the position of the South Pole, and he was attempting to sail to it, but he couldn't get further south. But he made it to about 78 degrees south. So that's about as far south as you can sail before you can't anywhere around the Antarctic continent.
Just gonna confirm something here.
Yeah.
South Pole would be 0 degrees.
90.
90 degrees.
Yeah, 90. The
zero
equator is
zero.
No,
the
equator is
zero.
Yeah, so the North Pole is 90 degrees north, the South Pole is 90 degrees south.
So as they're getting 78, they're getting further and further south, 90
exactly.
to South Pole.
Yeah, exactly.
Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
For the newbies out there.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So that was in the 1840s. Ross. Then in 1895, you have a Norwegian called Borchgrevink, who was the first person to perform an undisputed landing on the Antarctic continent, when he landed at a place called Cape Adare. He took some geological samples there.
Cool.
He established a rustic base where he made some scientific observations. And that's really when the sea-based exploration of Antarctica becomes the land-based exploration of the continent. And to be honest, I didn't think that this part of the podcast, would, this early exploration, would take so long. So we're going to turn this into a two-part episode, and we're going to finish the early exploration now. And then in the next episode, we're going to start talking about the big boys.
The big guys.
The names that you really will know and associate with Antarctica, and their kind of the race to the South Pole during that heroic age of exploration. So join us.
The drama. All the drama.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that this was interesting already. I think it's interesting personally.
Yeah.
And I think that some of these guys should be talked about. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're paving the way. You know, Scott and Amundsen and these guys that come next, they don't get there without...
Exactly.
Previous exploration.
Exactly. Absolutely. It all makes sense. All right. Join us for the next one.